You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
We're looking at the subject of the church here tonight, and immediately as we look at the subject of the church, people have many conceptions and misconceptions. For instance, some people would say a church is this. You know, it needs to be a building, it needs to have at least 3, 4, 5, 10 crosses on the outside for you to know that it's a church. When other people think about a church, they think of this here, which isn't even the worst part of that picture. Look at that guy. Oh my God. It's like Voldemort snuck into the church there. Wow. Other people think of this here, that it's just some kind of ecstatic, emotional singing experience. And what if I was to tell you that none of this is from the Bible? None of this stuff. Tonight, Peter is going to address the subject of what the church actually is. And in so doing, he's going to expose three different myths. Myth number one is that the church is a beautiful or a boring building. Let's look at that. Verse 4, he says, "Coming to him as to a living stone which has been rejected by men, but is choice and precious in the sight of God, you also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." Clearly, we're being cued in on the fact that this is metaphorical speak. He says that Jesus is a living stone, that we too are living stones, because now that Christians know the Christ, now that we know Jesus, we have become stones, but living stones. Obviously, this is metaphorical. You don't need to be a theologian to figure this out. Stones are inert hunks of rock. But these are living, inert hunks of rock. So what's he getting at here? Living stones being built up as a spiritual house. Now, wait a minute. I thought you just said that the church is not some kind of a building. But here it's saying that the church is precisely a building. I mean, a house, a spiritual house. Again, this is metaphorical. He says a spiritual house. It's not that all of us are hopping on each other's, you know, shoulders and stuff and trying to make some kind of creepy human centipede, you know, a house or something like that. Gross. That's not the picture here. He's drawing this from the Old Testament. The Old Testament temple, to be exact. He's looking at the Old Testament temple and he's saying, you know, the temple, what was the temple? The temple was a building, a huge ornate edifice that God had Solomon built in 1 Kings chapter 6. And he built this huge temple, gold-plated, covered with artwork and everything else. And after he filled it, or finished it, he filled it with his Spirit. At that point, in order to come into contact with God, you needed to go through the temple. So, temples. These are basically places where the transcendent and the imminent intersect. These are like a crossroads where you have the supernatural and the natural. And you can't just go into the natural realm. Primitive religions knew this. Religions today still know this, that there's a sense that you can't come into the presence of God or the gods. Well, in the Jewish faith, it was this way. They knew they couldn't just come into the presence of God. How do you get into a relationship with God? How do you get into his presence? You come through a temple, and you dare not try and come into the presence of God without a temple. It was Moses who asked God, "I want to see your face." And in Exodus 33, God said to Moses, "No one shall see my face and live." So it's actually pretty frightful to think about that, to come into the presence of an infinite personal God. You need a temple. And the Jewish temple was no different in this respect. It was different in other respects, but in this respect, this was the way that you could actually come into contact with God. But here's the thing. It really showed the separation between humans and God. So even though there was a doorway, it was a closed door. And there was only one guy once a year who could go into the temple. He was the high priest. So not just the priest, but the high priest. And he could only go in once a year on Yom Kippur, the day of ransom, the day of atonement. And this was all to show that you can't just come into God's presence. So why is Peter hearkening back to the Old Testament temple? Do you see it? Do you see what he's showing here? Foreshadowing that whole picture of God coming into the temple. In 2 Chronicles chapter 7, when Solomon dedicates the temple, it says that the priests saw the Shekinah glory, the glory of God, come down on the temple and shkadoosh. And the priests saw that and just hit the deck and no one could even look up at it. And I mean, these are the holy men, the holiest of the holy men couldn't even look at God. And now what he's saying here is that you are that temple. If we could go back in time 3,000 years and talk to one of these guys and say, you know, what would it be like to have the temple of God actually living inside your person? They would have just been dumbstruck. What do you mean? A God can't live inside a filthy, sinful human being. But by virtue of the cross of Christ, that is precisely what has happened. So, at this point, do we have a need for a temple today? Yes. Might surprise you. Yes. But we are that temple. The Christian, somebody who knows Christ, has the Holy Spirit living inside of her, living inside of him. And because of that, we become a temple where we have direct contact with God. And so he says, "For this is contained in Scripture, behold, I lay in Zion or Jerusalem a choice stone, a precious cornerstone, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed." Isaiah chapter 28. This is where the invading armies were coming down on Israel. And God says, "I'm going to put a choice cornerstone out there and you need to believe in it." But later rabbis said that that must be a messianic passage. So they actually switched it over into he who believes in him, that is the Messiah, and Peter, and Paul, Romans chapter 9, verse 33, and again in chapter 10, they use the same understanding to say that this is the way to come out from under the judgment of God. Just as those armies were coming in to attack, the same thing is true here, that the judgment of God is coming down on people, and the only way to get out from under the wrath of God is how? Through this cornerstone. So let's bring all this together. Why is it that Peter compares Christians and really all Christians on planet Earth as a temple? He says, "You also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house." If you were to see the temple of Herod or the temple of Solomon, the first temple or the second temple, doesn't matter. One thing you would be fairly confident of is this. Somebody built that. There wasn't just some kind of an explosion and all those rocks just happened to fit together in that wall. Somebody put this thing together. This was a huge, magnificent, beautiful, opulent temple. And Peter's saying that's the way the church is. The church isn't a building. The church is a body. The church isn't a place. The church is people. In case you were confused, when you walked in here, you thought this was a church. No, this looks more like a movie theater. Not like we're trying to fool anybody. The thing that's really special about this place is not the drywall. It's not the carpet. It's the people. Yeah, how did we get here? I don't know. How did I get here? I was never into God. All of a sudden I was. That must have been because an architect placed me into this incredible temple. So too, if we were to zoom in, we could see that these stones are so carefully locked in together, incredibly close. They said that a good architect or engineer could fit these stones so close together that you couldn't even slide a piece of paper through it. That's how tightly fixed they were. And the same thing is true for Christians. He's saying we're not just a bunch of thrown disparate rocks across the landscape or just out in the middle of nowhere. No, we are fitted tightly, closely together, almost like a jigsaw puzzle. That God himself, according to 1 Corinthians 12:18, he has fitted us just as he desired. And so to put us into this temple, this was his idea, and he was the architect, and he's designed it so that we would be incredibly close, sometimes even too close for comfort. And yet, by contrast, you look at the modern church today, you see things like this. You see icebreakers for small groups. Now, these are churches that are actually pretty good. They're actually doing small group ministry. How are they doing it? What do you do when you show up? You get your sheet. And what's on the sheet? Careless whispers. Picture whispers. Careless whispers. I could get into that. Candy introductions, story starters, two truths and a lie, truth or dare. We're adults here. What is this? The trust fall? Is that what we're going to do here? Okay, this isn't sinful or anything that they do this. There's nothing sinful about it. It's not like it's morally wrong. It's just, what does this show us? This is a window into the state of the anemic modern church today, where it's not that we actually are fitted together close, that we actually know each other, that we know about each other, but that we need a sheet to tell us what to do as adults so that we can actually get close. I just think this whole picture is bizarre. I've been part of these too. And it's weird. And the thing that really bothered me the whole time is I felt guilty because I'd look around and everyone else was into the trust fall or whatever. And I was like, maybe I should just kind of be a little bit less insecure and, you know, whatever, and just get into this. I don't think so. I think actually the problem is that we're faking being close. That's what that is. We're faking it. We don't really know each other. Otherwise, we wouldn't need a sheet like this, would we? So bizarre. Nothing, I just can't even imagine Peter seeing something like this and thinking, this is Christian community. This sounds like something you would do at a work introduction or something. I don't even know. I can't even compare it. It's terrible. So too, each stone took tremendous effort to get to that temple. These stones were heavy. And in the ancient world, the stones, those were valuable. Labor was cheap. And so you could move these stones on boulders or rather on logs. They had all sorts of instruments to be able to move these stones. And so the back-breaking labor, that was the cheap part. By contrast, these stones were incredibly valuable. That would have taken some effort. I mean, I don't know if you've ever picked up a big stone. It takes 2, 3, 4 guys to lift one of these things and to move it. The same is true for the Christian. It took God moving heaven and earth to get you sitting here right now. You think back on your story. You're like, how did I get here? I don't know. It must have been someone, something moving powerfully to get me to this point. So too, as we look at each individual stone in a building like this, they're all unique. They're all very diverse. They didn't have, you know, bricks that were cut out of a mold, that were just stamped out on some kind of a Henry Ford assembly line. Each one of them was very unique. If you work with rock, ice, whatever, it has a vein in it. So when you chip at it, sometimes you chip away properly as a sculptor. Other times it hits one of those veins and goes the wrong direction. And then you're stuck with this stone that's 150 pounds. What do we do with it? Well, it's very unique now. Now we have to fit it in with another stone that can fit in on the other side. And this whole picture is really an idea that really strikes us today. You know, whose religion is Christianity? Europeans? Asians? Australians? Don't tell me Canadians. People from Mozambique? People from Latin America? There is no demographic center of Christianity. This is one of the most unique parts of this world religion. If you look at other world religions, they have a certain geographical locale where people are the same ethnicity by and large. Christianity is no one's religion. It is across the globe. It's actually spreading in the non-Eurocentric world or Anglo-American world faster than in the American world. Very unique. In Revelation chapter 7, we read that people are going to come from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. That's 4 different ways of saying diversity. Yeah. And think about it like this too. If you look at those stones, you know, what if that bottom stone wasn't playing its role? What if that stone was just like, you know, I don't feel like being a stone today. I feel like staying home and looking at videos on my phone. I think I'm just going to stay home and do that. Well, that stone could do that, but the rest of the stones would crumble. That's what they would do. Or maybe it just sits there, but it's like, I just don't feel like holding anything up. I don't feel like carrying my weight today. Maybe if you had one stone, that'd be okay. What if you had 2, 3, 4, 7 stones like that? Oh, that would be a recipe for a disaster. Yeah. I don't think we're reading into this too much. He's saying you're being built up as a spiritual house. And really what he's trying to do here is to draw out all of the implicit nuances of what that would have been like to a first century reader. Think about this picture here. These stones are greater when assembled together. So a big bunch of stones on the ground, what do you call that? A mess, that's what you call that. An eyesore. Who's going to move all that? What are we going to do with that? That's just going to sit there? Somebody needs to come through and clean that up. That's a pile of junk. However, if you put all these stones together, I hate to use the word synergy, but synergy, they have synergy. They have more together than they do apart, more energy together than they do apart. To see some kind of an edifice like that would be assembling only together, though. That would be the key. Fitted together. I guess that would be true for us, too, as Christians. I've talked to some people. One guy, he was checking out our particular small group, and he just said, you know, I don't even know if I believe in God. But I will give you one thing. I said, what's that? He said, this group here. This is an awesome group of people. I said, I have to correct you there. No. This is not an awesome, we're people just like anybody else. We're just people. We're people. What you're seeing here is God. When these people come together as the temple, as the spiritual house, you're seeing something amazing. I'll grant you that, but it's not us. Don't be confused about that. You're experiencing God here. So too, each stone has a noticeable role. Like that stone on the left. What is that even doing there? If it was missing, would you miss it? Meh. The stone on the right, though, that's playing a noticeable role. If that was pulled out of the wall, not only would it crumble the wall, but it would also be an eyesore, wouldn't it? Absolutely it would. You'd notice that immediately. Isn't it sad in most churches today? You could go there week in, week out. No one would know your name. No one would know if you were missing. No one would know if you're even dead. Like that guy right there in the blue shirt, right there. You see him there on the bottom left? What if he wasn't? See, you can't see him. Because you can't tell anybody here in this picture. So too, a role. You know, what is it that people in the modern church give people to do? Like if you had a ministry team and they said, we're going to give you something really important to do, what would it be? Be a greeter. Or collect the money. Or, you know, maybe walk people to their seats, help people with their seats. Now, I'm not beating up on the greeters or the ushers here. I think that is a role to play. That is a role to play. I did have a professor, though. He was an expert in Semitic languages. Young guy, relational, funny, great teacher. I said, so where do you fellowship? You know, what group do you go to up in Wisconsin? He said, well, my wife and I just moved there. We're looking for a church. I said, so how's that going? He says, well, difficult. He said, you know, we went to one of the churches and I asked him how I could be involved. Here's a guy, a dedicated follower of Jesus, wanting to be involved, PhD in Semitic languages, best teacher in this room, that's for sure. What'd they give you to do? He said, well, I could be a greeter or an usher. Oh, here's a guy. In anywhere else, you know, in the world, he'd be making, you know, 6 figures. What about a doctor? A lawyer? You know, you get them out in the working world. They're able to do complex stuff. We put them in the church and we give them the equivalent of a minimum wage job. No role, no function, nobody being able to do anything. Yeah, we need these roles served. And if you ask me, if somebody said, you know, would you be willing to do that role? Yeah, I'd be willing to do that role. I'd be willing to scrub the toilets in the church, okay? Nothing's beneath me. I'll do that. No problem. But this is the only thing we're letting people do around here. No substantive work, nothing with any meaning or substance. That's just not the picture we're seeing here, is it? Finally, Jesus is the precious cornerstone in verse 6. See, in the ancient world, again, builders would have a cornerstone. They would spend, architects would spend an incredibly long amount of time picking out the proper cornerstone. This needed to be perfect, because once you laid this down into the ground, this would set the pace for the rest of the entire building project. It would be the sort of chalk line or the plumb line against which you would build the rest of the temple. This particular photograph here, this is actually from the southeastern wall of the Temple Mount. This is a 39-foot slab, 4 feet tall, so maybe to here, and 7 feet wide, 80 tons. And once that thing gets plopped down, there ain't no moving it. What's the significance here? Why is he called Jesus the cornerstone? Because we're being built on top of him. He's stable. He's immovable. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And any church that tries to build itself off of any kind of gimmicks, anything else, is doomed to fail. That's all it's ever going to be. It's just a gimmicky church. However you win people to a group like that is the same way that you're going to have to keep people. So if you win them through entertainment, then you're just going to have to keep them through that general entertainment. Jesus Christ, he is the one who attracts people. He's the one who changes lives. The precious cornerstone. So, myth number one, busted. The church isn't a building. It's not a place. It's the people. That's what makes it so special. Hope we never lose that. What about myth number two? To become a Christian, I need to join a church. To become a Christian, I need to join a church. Peter addresses this. He says, he who believes in him will not be disappointed. This precious value, then, is for you who believe. Notice what this is saying here. This is saying, in order to benefit from the incredible gift of Christ, you need to trust him. That's all that word means. It's pistuo, is belief. That just means trust, to trust in Christ. Notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say, he who had parents that went to church. It doesn't say, he who is inside of a church. It doesn't even say, he who visits a church or serves in a church or has some kind of a leadership role in a church. No. He who believes in him will not be disappointed. This precious value, then, is for you who believe. You can be in a church. You could be in this room. That does not make you a Christian. You know, I myself am not that good with auto mechanics. And I could go and stand in a garage. That wouldn't make me a mechanic, right? Stupid. I could go and I could walk into a movie theater. That doesn't make me the general manager of that theater. I could put on a tutu, but that wouldn't make me a ballerina. You catch my point? So too, I could walk into a church, and that doesn't make me a Christian. You know what makes you a Christian? Christ. That's what makes you a Christian, coming into a relationship with Christ. So we could think of it like this. Imagine if the Columbus Census did a study of all those who are on church membership rolls. They have official church membership in various churches. And they come to the number in Columbus, Ohio, that there's 300,000 official church members. But let's say from a God's eye view, God can see into the heart of every single person. And he actually sees that there's 400,000 Christians. But do you notice the Venn diagram here? Do you see the difference? Some of those people could not be in official church membership status. And some of those people could be in official churches, but not actually know Christ. 2 Timothy 2:19, Paul says, the Lord knows who are his. This isn't about the church thing. I don't care how involved you are in your church. I don't care how frequently you've gone or for how many years. That means nothing. That means zero. What matters is if you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. We're reading it right here. He who trusts in him. By contrast, he says, but for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone. To them, Jesus has become a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. That is offensive, isn't it? especially to the religious mind. Now, to the irreligious, they hear this message of free forgiveness, love and acceptance. They think this is the best thing they've ever heard. But to religious people, like the people to whom Peter is speaking here, this is the most offensive message they've ever heard. You're going to tell me, Peter, that all of my religious scruples, all of my meticulous moral minutiae, all of my good works, all of my time spent in prayer, all of that, all throughout the years, year after year, you're saying that means nothing according to God? Is that what you're saying? In this respect, that is precisely what Peter is saying. And you might hear that and be completely and utterly offended. You're saying my good works, my good deeds can never get me to God? Yes, they can never get you to God. And so for many people, this is a stumbling block. It's like tripping over. Go, what? What are you saying? Let me put it this way. If you do good works, that's good. That's great. If you're a good person, that's good. That's great. But what we're talking about here is eternity. How much would it cost you to get into eternity? A few good works? A few prayers? Oh, well, God knows my heart. God knows my heart. Okay, the question is not, does God know your heart? The question is, what's in your heart? Is Jesus Christ in your heart? Have you ever invited Jesus Christ into your heart? Oh, he knows my heart. Jeremiah 17:9 says that the heart is deceitful and wicked. Who can understand it? And I think upon a moment's reflection, we realize that. We look inside of ourselves. Here's my question. What do you do with your guilt? I've asked that question to so many people. I've never heard the response, what guilt? People know precisely what I'm talking about. You do too. You know that you have guilt. Where does it go? You need the offense of the cross to humble yourself and to receive this gift of forgiveness. It's a choice. He says, for they stumble because they are disobedient to the word, and to this doom they were also appointed. Whoa. You just said it was a choice. Oh, now what about this? So I guess we're appointed to doom. That sounds like a bad science fiction film there. Is this what we saw earlier, divine determinism? No. Look at the grammar here. The word this is a neuter, that is the gender of this pronoun, a neuter relative pronoun. This refers to the entire antecedent, what came before. So this modifies everything before it. What's that? For they stumble because they are disobedient to the word. To this doom they were appointed. See, if it was referring to individuals or even a plural group, it wouldn't use the neuter. The neuter refers to the entire clause. In other words, in the words of theologian Greg Blomberg, he says, it is a prearranged principle that those who disobey will stumble. Yeah, a little common sense never hurt. For they stumble because they are disobedient to the word. And if you're disobedient to the word, what doom is appointed for you? Well, precisely this. If you're going to reject and disbelieve Christ, then what you're saying is, I want to pay for my own sins. It's because you're disobedient to the message. So, to become a Christian, you need to be in a church, serve in a church. No. Busted, number two. What about number three? The purpose of the church is to sing songs. Oh man, I'm angering. What's the word? I can't talk. I'm making everyone angry is what I meant to say. I'm like, it's a really complicated word, angry. Myth number three, the purpose of the church is to sing songs. This pretty much just ticks off everybody. Everyone gets angry about this. If you're a Christian, nobody else cares. Peter says, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. So all of us are priests in the sense that we bring people to God, just like the priest would bring a sacrifice to the temple. So we too are priests in the sense that we mediate and help people come to know God. We help bring people to the temple, so to speak. You see the metaphor? When people come to the temple, they meet God. And when people come to the church, the group of Christians in community, they come to meet God there. So in that sense, we're all priests. That's what it's saying here. so that you may proclaim the praises of him. Oh, man, I wish that word wasn't there, because I just said myth number three, the purpose of the church is to sing songs. And then it says, so that you may proclaim the praises of him. So it is. So God has done all this. He built this incredible temple, one by one, putting people into this temple, moving heaven and earth and everything in between. And what's our purpose? Well, you're a holy priesthood, holy nation, chosen for what? To sing. Well, let's look at this word praises. Arete, this word, means actually virtue or excellence of character. Don't believe me? Every other time in the New Testament, arete is translated. It is always translated as moral virtue, excellence. Guess how it's never translated? Praise. Never translated praise. That's not in there. What about when we get into Homeric Greek? Or we get into Septuagintal Greek, like the Old Testament Greek? What about never, 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 never? It's always praise, it's always excellence, never praise. I got praise on the mind. Excellence of character. Let's look at how our own author, in his next letter, uses this. 2 Peter 1:5, make every effort to add to your faith praise, goodness. This is the same translation committee, the NIV, so that you may proclaim the praises of him. And in the next book, by the same author, they translated goodness and virtue. Oh, no, no, no. Excellency, so that you may proclaim the excellence. So you might be like, oh, that's real cute. We did a little study of the word arete. Wonderful. What's the point? Oh, big, big difference here. So you may proclaim the virtues of him, the goodness of God. That's different, isn't it, than the praises of him? So this wouldn't be that we're sitting there coming together and our purpose as a church is to sing to God. The purpose of the church is to share and declare how good God is to whom? To people that don't know him. And to share about what? To share how he has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. For you were once not a people, but now you are the people of God. There's the context. Sharing, I used to be like this, and I didn't know God, and now I do. That's what we're sharing with people. The goodness of God. I can't believe that. I wasn't one of God's people. Now I am. You had not received mercy. I never had forgiveness, but now you have received mercy. Oh, that'd be something. That would be something to give your life away to, right there. That'd be a purpose worth devoting your time, your talent, and your treasure. Singing. No. I don't see that. I don't see that in the text. It's not that I don't prefer it. I want to be very clear. I actually like to sing, believe it or not. But I don't think that is the purpose of the church. Why? Because I don't think that I personally prefer it. I happen to not prefer it. But also, the text is what governs us here. Let's get a different perspective. Sally Morgenthaler, this is from her book. It's called Worship Evangelism. Evangelism comes from the word euangelion, just means the good news of Jesus. So to share about what Jesus has done. She came up with this whole idea back in 1995. She had the idea that basically if we have these incredible worship services, then people that don't know Christ will be drawn to them and want to check this out. I wonder what they're doing in that church. Whoa, interesting. And so she came up with this whole book. It was called Worship Evangelism. Here's what she writes. She says, unbelievers, people that don't know Christ, will draw lasting conclusions about the veracity and uniqueness of our God based on what they see or do not see happening in our weekly church services. So somebody's going to stand there and look at somebody singing, and they're going to look at this, and what are they going to draw conclusions of? The veritas, the veracity, the truthfulness of God, and the uniqueness of God. They're going to be there in a worship service going, whoa, God is real. He's true. He's unique. These Christians, the way they sing to God, there's something real here. She adds, do they detect something supernatural and life-changing going on? Can they sense God's presence and work among us? Are they experiencing something in our midst that they've never seen before? I'm suspicious of this. I don't know. I just can't imagine, as somebody who wasn't into God, to come into a group of people who are all singing songs that I've never heard, to a God I don't believe in, I don't know any of the lyrics, And I'm supposed to sit here? That's going to make me feel really comfortable? I don't think so. Guess who else doesn't think so? Sally Morgenthaler. A few years later, 2007, she wrote this in a magazine article. She said, in 2001, a worship-driven congregation in my area finally did a survey as to who they were really reaching, and they were shocked. I was not shocked, but let's see what you think. They thought their congregation was at least 50% unchurched. The real number was 3%. What is this? What is this? Basically putting on a show, putting on a production, and I've seen them all, man. Fog machines, lasers, some of the best singers you've ever heard. They're double good looking. I mean, they're out there dancing, singing. I mean, you're like, this is incredible. And this is going to draw non-Christians to this? Why would non-Christians want to go to a Christian worship service? This whole thing is so allergic. I just would never want to go to something like that. What this draws is not people that aren't interested in Christ. This draws Christians from other churches into this church. This is basically the Walmart of churches. Like when Walmart opens up and you have all the little mom and pop shops, everyone stops going to them and goes to the Walmart. So it moves everyone into that big, you know, mega church. And it's interesting that all these mega churches appeared right around the same time as, you know, the big CEO, Fortune 500, you know, big business companies were really booming. The church is always a little bit behind the world, and they had the idea, we can't just have a church, we need a mega church. And so how do you do this? Well, most of these guys have studied business on how to draw people, and they come up with these kind of ideas. And they don't mind spending the money either, because this draws people in. Look at this. I'm not going to show you which church this is, or any of these, but here is their budget. This church has a $43,000 budget. $13,000, about a third of that, worship. This is a tiny church, small budget. A third of their money is going to worship. What about a big church? Worship music. $138,000, 20% of their budget, worship. And by that, they mean singing. That's what they mean. What about this one? Here's a big church. Worship, $2 million out of their budget, and then communication and the arts, which is worship also. So $2.6 million. That's a huge chunk of, that's God's money right there. These people were showing up giving money that they worked hard for to give to this church just to be entertained. Oh, I just think this whole thing is so bizarre. I'll just say that. I need to restrain myself, but this is so bizarre. Not in the Bible. We don't have a single prescription in the Bible. In the New Testament for a worship service. Does not exist. I've read the Bible. Isn't in there. We have no imperatives for it. We have no example of a worship service in the New Testament. People say, well, what about the Psalms? Yeah, guess what else is in the Psalms? Animal sacrifices. You want me to slaughter a sheep up here and then we can have our worship service? This doesn't exist, isn't in the text, creates a consumer mentality. That's what this is. People become really, what's the word? Connoisseurs of church. Like wine people, your friend, you know. I can taste the oaky nuttiness of the, I don't know anything about wine. Is that what they say? I don't know. The tannins or something, you know. And this is how people are with church. Oh, I like that part. I like the teaching over there, and I like the personality over there, and I like the music over there, but I like Christmas over here. And basically, they've become these connoisseurs of church, like they're little consumers. What are we reading here? What are we reading? That we're supposed to be connoisseurs? Really good at tasting what is good about the church and critiquing everything? No. The whole purpose of the church is to win the world for Jesus Christ, nothing less. Here's Greg Laurie, my guy. I like this guy here. He says, the past two decades have witnessed a dramatic increase in the number of large churches, including megachurches, congregations of 1,000 or more around the country. But during that very time, megachurches have sprouted across the landscape. The proportion of Americans who claim to be, what did Peter call it? Born again, that you had a rebirth, that you came to Christ. The claim to be born again has remained a constant 32%. What? That can't be possible. All these mega churches are appearing. How's that possible? But all the same number of Christians, huh? He says growth isn't coming from conversions, like people actually meeting Christ in a living way, but from transfers. They go from this church to that church. Up to 80% of all growth taking place today. That's like if I went out the door today and I said, hey, honey, to my wife. Not to any of you I happen to be looking at. You know, can I get 10 bucks? I was going to hit Chipotle, and she gives me 10 bucks, and I go out to the store, and I'm like, here's my money, give me my burrito, and they give me my thing. And I'm like, I just made 10 bucks. Stupid. Her money is my money. Why would I care about seeing Christians coming from another church into our church? Just so we can be bigger? Is that what this is? So we can have a real big church? Big buildings and all that kind of stuff. What's the point? What is the point of that? How about actually reaching people with Jesus' message of love and forgiveness that are hurting, that don't even know him? What about those people? Lori says, some church growth experts are telling pastors their quote-unquote customers no longer attend to commune with God, but to consume a personal or family service. They're consumers. In a recent survey of 1,000 church attenders, respondents were asked, why does the church exist? That is our question right there, isn't it? According to 89%, the church's purpose was to, quote, take care of my families and my spiritual needs. Only 11% said the purpose of the church is to win the world for Jesus Christ. That is spiritually sick. We got a whole world out there of people hungering for God, wanting to know the love of God. And here we have people all inside the church thinking about me, myself, and I. Oh, so different from what we're reading here from Peter. So to bring all this together, what are we seeing? The church is not a place. It's people. What is it that's going to make this church great? The people. What is it that's going to make this church terrible? The people. As one person said, the best evidence for Christianity is Christians. The worst evidence for Christianity is Christians. The quality of people, the way that we're coming together as the temple of God to reflect the glory of God and the love of God and the mercy of God. That's what the church is. So different than what we are accustomed to. What's our purpose as a church? Our primary purpose is to share Jesus' message of love and forgiveness with people that don't know about this. You know, the feeling that you get when you see people understand the love of God for the first time. The lights come on in their eyes. Their heart is warmed. This is not just some kind of a psychosomatic, psychological experience. This is real. The change is real. I've seen it happen time and time again where people's lives are changed. That is our purpose here. Oh, what an awesome purpose that is, to actually play an influence on people that's meaningful. And finally, we do not become a Christian by joining a church, this church or any other. You ever hear that? That isn't in the Bible. You become a Christian, and let me put this as clearly as I can, by just asking Jesus to forgive your sins and to come into your life once for all. If you've never done that, you should do that here with us tonight. What are you waiting for? Why are you putting off that decision? You should just do that here. Lower your pride. Get over the offense. It's offensive. Drop the self-righteousness and just say, I want your forgiveness. I need it. I quit. I surrender. I need you. And at that point, Peter says, he who believes in Jesus will not be disappointed. Oh, yeah. I've been following Christ for years now, and I can attest to that. Although, as we move on into eternity, we certainly will not be disappointed that we ever made that decision. And that's all we had for tonight.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.